Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. We're wrapping up a series. It's gone a little longer than we thought it would, just because of various vacations of staff, and I had some time off there, too. With Suzanne Venker on Working Mothers, this is the conclusion of a seven-part series. We've been walking through the seven myths that comprise her book, The Seven Myths of Working Mothers, one by one. Yesterday we talked about daycare. As we go into this hour with Suzanne Venker, I want you to bear a few things in mind. First of all, we're devoting an entire hour to this conversation with Suzanne at the end of this series for your questions and your comments. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And by way of rounding out our conversation with her, we do have one loose string about daycare to tie up here before we start talking about, well, I know of someone, a woman, she's got her life planned out. She does. At least she thinks she does. And kids fit in there, but according to her plan, kids have to come in a certain order and they have to come at a certain interval. Now, the problem here is that her body is not cooperating with her plan. Her plan was to have her first child and then very shortly afterwards, within a couple of years, have her second child. Well, you know, she hasn't had that second child yet. Although they have been trying. Things aren't going according to plan. I think she had originally planned to continue her schooling and have a career. And I don't know if that plan is still in place because, after all, the second kid isn't cooperating by not showing up yet. Kids have a tendency to bring to naught our adult plans, don't they? I mean, one thing you can be guaranteed, all the things that you have planned in advance of your first child's birth will all pretty much be tossed out the window when that first child shows up. So how do we deal with this myth so common among working mothers? Look, it's going to work for me. I'm going to be able to pull this off because I've planned it out. And is there anything wrong with planning in the first place? You know, there's some value to it. We'll be talking about that with Suzanne Venker. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Suzanne Venker is a regular guest here on Issues Etc., a former middle school English teacher, mother of two here in St. Louis, and author of the new book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. Suzanne, welcome back.
Hi, Todd.
You had something you wanted to wrap up from last time, something very important on the subject of daycare, yesterday's conversation, that we didn't get to. What is it?
I did. I just had neglected to mention something that I feel it is so important, and that is this. You know, daycare is so often, when it's compared to at-home motherhood, for example, people who believe in daycare like to think that raising children of that age is just about, you know, making sure they sleep and have some food and, you know, they're relatively safe and just these somewhat benign things occur according to people who, believe in daycare. And the point that I didn't make yesterday that I want to make is that it's within a mom and child's daily routine that a human being becomes who he or she is. And that is to say that what seems very perhaps uneventful to an outside observer, if one were to look in to see what goes on throughout the day between mom and baby or mom and toddler, and yet while it appears uneventful, it's actually enormously powerful. And it's within that, you know, we've talked about this, I think, a couple weeks ago, that elusiveness to motherhood that we can't put our finger on and say, for example, what it is we did that day. And so it makes it appear as though it was not productive. And yet it's within those seemingly unproductive series of days that mom and baby are bonding and this child is being created. And so that I just wanted to emphasize that to point out that that is absolutely not something that can be replicated in daycare.
You tell the story very early on as we talk about this last myth, I have it all planned out, about actress Valerie Bertinelli, one time, I think she was at one time married, may still be married in some form, to Eddie Van Halen. I mean, this woman married a rock star, she had a television career, and yet after her children came along, what did you remember an interview with her with Lifetime? What did she say?
She had an interview on Lifetime. And in that interview, they, you know, were going through her life. And when they got to the part that had to do with having her son, she said, the interviewer asked her how her life as a mom was different from her previous life. And her answer was, what life? I don't remember my life at all before I had my son. Whatever it was, it didn't matter. And I thought, wow, isn't that, A, probably how most women in the world feel, but B, how often do you ever hear that on TV, particularly from a high-profile person whose life, you know, doesn't match any of ours by a long shot as far as being on TV and supposedly having this glamorous life. And yet even somebody like that could say, guess what, it doesn't matter, nothing matters. And it's so not PC to acknowledge that side of motherhood. And so I thought that was very rare and very good, and so I wanted to quote that in the book.
Now, I want you to make this point early on in this conversation, Suzanne, because you've made it before in previous conversations, and I don't want it to go unsaid here as we critique the myth that if we just have it all planned out, then this whole issue of working motherhood is just going to fall in place if our plan is sufficient. You're not against planning per se. In fact, you seem to be a rather staunch advocate of women planning. Tell us about it.
I am. And so the important thing to understand is, what are we talking about when we're talking about planning? I lay out in this chapter that we're going to discuss tonight what impedes the process of women who plan to have children be what I would refer to as kind of a sideline occupation to their otherwise more eventful or more important life, that being the career. And I lay out why that plan is going to fall by the wayside. And then that leads into the conclusion of the book, which says, yes, you do want to plan. That part's right. What's not right is that you don't plan kids around careers. You plan careers around kids. And you make having children, assuming, of course, you want them. There's no obligation that you have them. But if you do want that life, that becomes the focal point of your life, and that you fit everything else in around that.
When the typical advocate, and we're talking about here advocate, not just someone who stumbled into it, but the advocate of working motherhood says, look, you need to make a plan, and you can have it all if you plan it out carefully enough. Child one will come along in year six of your career. You'll take some time off. You'll return to your career, and then after a decent interval pursuing your career, child two will come along, and you can work all these things out. After all, we've got all sorts of methods for birth control and contraception, and it's all feasible. The average person who thinks in those terms, do they realize when making that plan what change a mother goes through when the child is born?
No, absolutely not. And that, of course, is the problem. And I can think of, I'm thinking of women now who are in the phase of what you're talking about, who have yet to have children. And it's so unfortunate because they don't know what's going to hit them. And you could make the argument, of course, and I even acknowledge this in this chapter, that it's really impossible to understand completely. And I understand that. But that doesn't mean that just because it's so hard to grasp until you're in the throes of it, that we cannot discuss the reality of what happens, much in the way Valerie Bertinelli did, so that at least there is this understanding from people before they have children that it is so monumental, that it is going to cause you to want to care about nothing else but your baby, and that not only that, the needs of children are so endless and overwhelming that even if you hypothetically or philosophically wanted to do two things at the same time, you're not going to be able to. And so my argument is that because this is not fostered in society and within the media in the way that this Valerie Bertinelli pointed it out, then that's what's causing women to fail. It's what's causing them to think that it's one way, that it's, in other words, no big deal, and the kids can kind of come along with you. And then they get in the throes of it, and they realize that that's a lie. You know, the opening to that chapter that we're talking about, I borrowed a phrase from, I quoted this Lori Wagner at the beginning,
yeah.
And it says, and she had written a book, on motherhood, and I loved the phrase, so I used it here. It says, I had it all planned out. I'd birth Ruby, bond with her, and then resume life as I knew it, writing, working, reading, going to movies and restaurants. Ruby would be nearby, strapped on to me like some exotic appendage, delightful, lovely, and obedient, living my life with me. And then one June, Ruby came. And needless to say, she learned that was completely false.
The best laid plans.
Yeah, right. And that's my argument here, is that it's not about children living our lives with us. It's the complete reverse of that.
We're talking with Suzanne Venker, author of the book Seven Myths of Working Mothers. In this hour-long conclusion to our series on working mothers, we invite your questions and your comments. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. If there's something we've mentioned in the course of this long series that struck your fancy or with which you disagree, feel free to give us a call. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Suzanne, you were talking about the inability to understand this before it actually occurs. Marriage, all the big changes in our lives work this way. I remember someone saying to my wife and I before, when my wife was pregnant with our first child, but it was before the child was born, we were talking about what was going to happen after the child was born, blathering on as new parents, prospective parents would be. And this person said, you just don't get it. They said, you are thinking about your life after the baby comes in the terms of your life now, without the baby there in your arms. Once the baby is in your arms, everything is going to change. Not just some things, not just your schedule, not just the way you plan out your life. Everything is going to shift. And until that baby was stuck in my arms, I'll tell you what, I didn't understand it. But from that, I think parenthood is the lifelong pursuit of trying to understand what changed when that baby was born.
Yeah, and so I mentioned the four, in this chapter I identify the four, what I think are the four main things that do happen, that it is true, again, that it's hard to fathom it in the way that you just said until you do. But I preface, before I'd mention those four things, I preface it by talking about what I think, how my generation, I should say, is at such a disadvantage from previous generations in that we have been groomed not for a life at home but for a life at the office. And so, and then of course in addition to that, we have postponed children till our 30s, many of us, and had these careers and these lives often while we're married. But it doesn't really matter whether we're married or single. The point is we have these lives that people in previous generations didn't because they had children right away. And these other lives consist of, gosh, freedom, money, focus on oneself, travel, all, you know, this, you know, otherwise easy life where everything is very predictable and fits into the box that we want it to. And so when motherhood does finally come along, it's even more challenging for us to kind of stop the life that we've known to then revamp and change our lifestyle. And I think to some extent that's where people in previous generations were at an advantage because they didn't really have that to compare that other life. Now, of course, that begs the question of, does that mean people should postpone having have their children sooner rather than later? And we don't need to get into that now, but there are, you know, positives and negatives to both. But that is one way in which the previous generations, I think, were at an advantage.
No, the first way you describe this, it's not just a shift of gears. It's a whole new life after children, is in terms of falling in love. What do you mean?
Yes, that's one of the four things that I have kind of picked as what I thought were the major things that occurred after we have children. The first one is falling in love. And what I say there is what I call this shocking discovery for women, that they find out how instinctive their desire to mother is and how they fall in love with their babies. And again, that goes back to that statement from Valerie Bertinelli, which is why I used it. I keep coming back to that. But it's this, what? Nobody said anything about this. We don't ever talk about, again, loving babies so much so that we just want to take care of them, and we really don't care about those other plans. So because nobody talks about it, we're shocked, you know, to find out how natural and normal it is to want to take care of your babies. It's not normal and natural to want to put them in a daycare. That doesn't make any sense. It goes against what is human. And I think that's, of course, that begs the question of the guilt, of course, because you get into, that natural feeling that you have when you do put your baby in daycare. The reason why you have that ambivalence is not because society put that on you, as feminists like to say, but because it's instinctively not natural to do that. And so that's what I discuss with respect to falling in love.
You go even further than that, Suzanne. You talk about society's refusal to acknowledge these intense emotions.
Right.
We talk about it as bonding or intimacy that accompany motherhood, that accompany that moment with the child in your arms.
Yeah, exactly.
Because how does society refuse to acknowledge
it? Well, it refuses to do it because it's going to undo all the work of the women's movement. You see, I mean, for the past 40 years, we cannot acknowledge that reality, that natural reality, because if you do that, then the women's movement cannot go forward with its agenda. It requires that you don't have that instinctual desire. So it has a vested interest in kind of steering you away from that natural way about you. There's all kinds of ways that the women's movement does that, but when it comes to babies and moms, this is what they do. They don't want that to be true, and so they're kind of tweaking it to make it make mothers feel as though it's not natural and normal to want that, when of course it is, and you know that the moment you feel it.
Suzanne Venker is our guest. We're wrapping up our 7-part series on working mothers, talking about the final myth, I have it all planned out. Feel free to join us with a question or a comment at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. As I said before, we've devoted the entire hour so that we can also take your questions and your comments during this last hour of Issues Etc. today. Now, the best callers during this hour will get a free copy of Suzanne's book, 7 Myths of Working Mothers. It's been the basis for this series, and the best callers at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, the best caller during this hour, will receive a free copy of Suzanne's book, 7 Myths of Working Mothers. So to wrap that one up, Suzanne, it sounds as though the women's movement, from its very beginning, has had to undermine not just staying at home being a housewife.
Mm-hmm.
It has had to undermine motherhood in order to advance. Is that putting it too harshly?
That's correct. That's correct. And they keep running into a brick wall, of course, because they're finding that the overwhelming majority of mothers don't want what the women's movement wants them to want. In other words, they keep running up against nature, I guess is the best way of putting it. They keep finding that, wait a minute, so many women aren't jumping on this bandwagon because they're feeling otherwise in their hearts. And so there's a conflict there. The last thing I say in that section on falling in love is that putting children first is considered beneath us as women. But loving her child more than herself does not lower a woman's status, it raises it. Motherhood elevates women, which is one of the intrinsic rewards of sacrifice. A stronger society would recognize this. So that's, and again, society meaning that, well, that's the women's movement trying to undermine that.
The second way you describe the change that motherhood is for a woman, and I think it probably goes as well for fathers to a lesser degree, you talk about it in terms of being a shift in values. Tell us about
that. Yeah, and I'm glad you point out the fathers here. Please keep bringing them up as much as possible, because I do sometimes forget to talk about them because this is such a mom issue, but it's really more of a parent issue. And yes, it does happen to men as well. But my little short section on values just basically points out that, you know, this generation is so hell-bent on postponing children as though, you know, you have to have this wonderful, free life prior to having children because, you know, once you have children, it's all over. You know, just forget it. You know, you can never leave your house again. It's just such an awful life. So let's get it out now while we can. And, of course, in previous generations, they did not view it this way. Children was the reason why you it was the reason we were here, really. I mean, you once you grew up, that was the next phase. And today we want to postpone our youth as long as we possibly can and get our own needs met and then push that other life away. And so my point there is that that shift will occur regardless of when you do it, whether you're younger or older, but it's a wonderful shift. It's not a shift to necessarily be postponed just for the sake of, you know, not wanting to have a life of sacrifice. That life that you're pushing off is actually a life far greater than what you are embracing before you have children. And that's the point of that.
Well, you know what strikes me about this, and you mentioned before fathers, but it does strike me as kind of a cord of guilt. The degree to which my wife and I, other couples I know, who ought to know better and who would agree wholeheartedly with the things in your book,
mm-hmm.
Have bought into this way of thinking about kids as, well, you know, that was before we had kids. We had fun before we had kids. Those were the salad days, you know, before we had kids. Thinking about our lives in terms of, you know, B.C., kind of before kids, as though those were some glory days, and life is, what, kind of dreary and drab now.
Right, and I do try to acknowledge that feeling, because we all have it. And I talk in this chapter not just about what's wonderful from sacrifice and what's great about having kids, but I absolutely get into the nitty-gritty in this book about what isn't so great about it and the things that are difficult and make it such a challenge. And it's because of those times that it is so natural, I think, to long for those days before you had those responsibilities. So it's not that I dismiss them and say, oh, isn't this lovely and glamorous and wonderful to have children. It has these other, you know, uglier sides. But we have to keep our eyes on the prize, so to speak, our focus when it comes to why we do what we're doing. And that's all I'm trying to point out here.
Our call-in numbers during this hour-long conclusion to our series on working mothers with Suzanne Venker, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's go to the phones and talk first with Frank. He calls from Chesterfield. Frank, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for taking my call, Todd. And I certainly applaud your guest for the work that she's done on a very important topic. I joined the issue from the perspective of a father, husband, grandfather, and as a Christian who wonders when we men of the Church of Jesus Christ look at this issue and react responsibly, perhaps with the aid of this book, which I look forward to reading, but in guiding and instructing our daughters, our families, as to how to get reoriented in a biblical perspective.
Frank, thank you for the call.
Thank you, sir.
Suzanne, no one expects you here to be a theologian, mm-hmm. but let's talk in practical terms about, and you will speak to this as a mother, but give us some advice as fathers. I've got a daughter at home, and I would like very much my daughter not to think in the terms that we have been trying to dispel in this series.
Mm-hmm.
I would like her very much to look forward to motherhood, not as an intrusion on her life.
Mm-hmm.
But the way she did when she was little, you know how little girls
right.
think about being mom, and they have their babies, and they can't think of anything greater than what it would be to be a mommy. I want her to keep that on the day when she says I do to some man who'll have to pass through my screening process. That's what she looks forward to.
Yeah.
We've got about 30 seconds here, and I'd like you to at least give a beginning to the answer.
Okay. I would do it very carefully with your wife because, you know, men don't seem to, unfortunately, have the ability to speak to this because people in the women's, well, let's put it this way, feminism has not allowed men to have the voice that they should when it comes to parenting. So in light of that, I would tell my daughter that there's a powerful force out there, and it has really taken over, and it will try to tell you one thing regarding motherhood and particularly how it pertains to careers, but I'm here to tell you this. And then that this is, of course, what you personally think. And if it happens to be what I've written, great.
Suzanne Venker is our guest. When we come back, we're going to talk more about that question raised by our caller. I invite the rest of you to call during this break, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Have you ever finished reading a Bible book, but then felt frustrated because several of your questions went unanswered? Well, you'll find a helpful resource when studying the Old Testament book of Leviticus with the New Concordia Commentary on Leviticus. It's our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June. You can find out more about this commentary under the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. That's 1-800-325-3040. The Concordia Commentary on Leviticus costs $42.99 plus shipping and handling. How does each chapter of Leviticus find its fulfillment in Jesus Christ? And what was the purpose of the detailed instructions in the so-called divine speeches of Leviticus? Find out with the Concordia Commentary on Leviticus by Dr. John Kleiner. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, the Concordia Commentary on Leviticus.
Languages. Do they change at all?
Answers with Ken Ham, one of the writers and editors of Creation Magazine. Well, Ken, we know that in the English language, words have changed meaning over the centuries. Is it possible that the Hebrew language of the Bible has changed, so can we really trust the words of the Bible we use today?
Well, a man called me to say that we can't insist that God created everything in six literal days. He said that the Hebrew word for day in the first chapter of Genesis may have changed meaning, therefore it was perhaps not a literal day when it was first used. I explained that if this was so, and using his logic, it would be possible that every word in the Bible may have changed meaning. Thus, you wouldn't be able to trust anything written in the Bible. But compared to English, Hebrew is a very stable language. Also, I'm sure that over the years, as the scribes painstakingly copied the scriptures, they would have made special note if a word had drastically changed meaning. The Hebrew word for day in the context of Genesis chapter 1 means an ordinary day. God created everything in six 24-hour days. It's so sad that many compromising Christians will try anything not to believe what the Bible makes so obvious.
Does that also mean dinosaurs were created during the same creation week, 24-hour literal days? Ken Ham has the answer in a free booklet, What Really Happened to the Dinosaurs? Read our free booklets on dinosaurs, Cain's wife, extraterrestrial life, and many other fascinating topics. The booklets are free at AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Should you allow your children to watch television news? It depends on their age and level of maturity, but keep in mind the news can be frightening. According to the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, the crime rate has decreased in recent years. Yet the reporting of crime in the news has increased 240%. This can make the world seem like a very scary place. Remember that all news is not appropriate for all children. But if your children are frightened by the news, encourage them to talk about it. Remind them that Jesus loves them and that He is always with them to protect and defend them. Nothing can ever pull them away from His loving arms. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Earlier today on our Bible study program, we talked about Ezekiel 25 through 28 with Pastor Kevin Parviz, and I wondered if Satan did not make a symbolic appearance in chapter 28. I put that question to Pastor Parviz. You can hear his answer tonight by tuning into the Bible study repeat at 7:05. I hope you'll join us this evening for the Bible study repeat.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk about the Bush presidency with Bill Salmon of the Washington Times. He's written this book called Misunderestimated about President Bush and his first term. We'll also talk about the rise of evangelicalism with none other than Dr. Mark Knoll of Wheaton College. I can think of few other than Knoll or Oz Guinness. There are a few others who bring the kind of expertise to the issue of evangelicalism, and Knoll is probably among the top of those who can bring their expertise to the issue of evangelicalism here on Issues Etc. tomorrow. We're in the middle of our conclusion in the 7-part series on Working Mothers with Suzanne Venker. She is a former middle school English teacher, mother of two here in St. Louis, and author of the book Seven Myths of Working Mothers. You can purchase the book Seven Myths of Working Mothers by calling Spence Publishing toll-free 1-888-SPENPUB. That's 1-888-SPENPUB. It's currently being offered at half price, 1-888-SPENPUB, or you can order Seven Myths of Working Mothers by our guest in this hour, Suzanne Venker, online at www.spencepublishing.com. It's all one word, www.spencepublishing.com. Before the break, we had a caller ask about what fathers could do to help their daughters rightly understand motherhood when they're still young. I asked you about the fathers. What about mothers? How can mothers instill in their daughters a love and anticipation of motherhood?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I guess by accentuating the positive rather than not ignoring the negative, by the way. I'm not, you know, in fact, the next section after the shift in values has to do with the reality of the first year of motherhood and how that cannot be, that's often not pretty. But not ignoring the negative, but accentuating what it is that you do gain from it, rather than there being this focus of what we lose as women. That's probably my biggest concern. And then when it comes to how it can be combined with careers, well, you know what? That's just an issue, in my opinion, of more, it's more of a practical thing. It's not a philosophical thing. And I think that's often what the divide seems to be in the media and in society, is that some people believe this versus some people who believe this. But in reality, what many people come to find out, it's more an issue of feasibility and practicality. That, in other words, once you understand the amount of work involved, once you accept that raising children is in itself a full-time job, the idea of, doing another full-time job alongside it is simply absurd. But it takes the acceptance and understanding of what's involved to even, agree with what I just said. So, you know, to me, that's what I intend to do with my daughter, is to accentuate what is wonderful about it and also impress upon her the lack of ability to perform two full-time jobs at the same time, and that whatever other aspirations she has are all well and good, and they should all be tended to, but just, you know, not at the same time. That's really my only argument.
Join us at 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. Greg joins us calling from his car. Greg, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues Etc.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to thank your guest for this book. My wife and I have done what she's doing for 20 years. For my daughter's 12. My wife quit working when she was pregnant. She stays home with my two kids. And I don't think people realize how comforting it is knowing who's taking care of your kids, specifically who's taking care of your kids and what they're being taught, and my morals and not somebody else's morals. The thought of putting your kid in a daycare and hoping that they're being taught the standards and morals that you have, to me, it's a scary thing to even imagine. It was tough financially when my wife quit working that year. We took about a $13,000 pay cut, and there's no way you can do that without making some major changes. But you just quit buying stuff. We used to, we had a new car and we bought all kinds of new furniture, and you just quit. And you put your money where it matters, and that's towards your kids, because they don't care that you've got a brand new couch and you've got a shiny car. They just care that mom's there. This idea of quality time, I don't know that I've ever had my kid tell me that they wished I spent better time with me. What I hear is, when do you spend time with me? If I had to work overtime, the first thing out of my kid's mouth was, I want you to spend time with me, not fabulous, 2 minutes of fabulous time, but a lot of time.
Greg, thank you very much. Man, a good synopsis of the entire series here.
He said so many things there I want to address, one of which is, this goes back to what we were saying about if you haven't been out in the working world first before you had children for, a decade or whatever, and had that other life, you don't think of what it is you're missing, and that's what makes it so different from previous generations. The reason why there was no concept of having to work back then is because they never got used to having all those niceties, all those extra things. So it really wasn't a big deal to them. It's only the comparison of having to live one way and then go down in your standard of living, if you want to put it that way, financially, that it makes it so daunting for today's generation. And secondly, there's a great quote, I happen to have it here, from, remember how we talked about the daycare decision and William and Wendy Dreskin? She and I have struck up a nice email relationship, and she just wrote a review of my book on Amazon.com. And this Wendy Dreskin, remember, was a director of a daycare center, and they quit after opening it. After having opened it for about a year, and because they were so dismayed by what they saw. But in this review of my book, she referred back to that time, and she said, and your caller made me think of this, I also had ample opportunity working in daycare to see children's perspective on what was important in their lives. I vividly remember a mother trying to soothe her children who were upset at being left in the morning by saying, Mommy is working so we can afford a trip to the snow on the weekend. You like trips to the snow, don't you? With tears in his eyes, the older boy, age 4, said solemnly, No, Mom, we'd rather have you.
Oh, man.
These are the kinds of things that Wendy saw on a daily basis, which caused them to have to close the center down because, you know, the alternative was to tell all the mothers the truth, and, of course, they wouldn't want to hear it, and it's just a mess. So they just stopped doing it altogether. But your caller, Greg, I think it was, made me think of that. You know, that's the reality of what it looks like on a daily basis, and that is not the reality that most people have. He also brought up talking about fathers and men's role in this. And I'm actually thinking about putting together a book that is kind of like the same idea as this book, but it's from the male perspective and from, or I should say father's perspective, because I've had such an overwhelming response in the last 4 weeks or 5 weeks since this book has been out from men, almost more so than women, believe it or not. And I feel like there's an untapped market there with fathers who, of course, we are taught by mass media and the women's movement are secondary to women. And why should they have such a strong opinion about, you know, their wives being at home with their children? Because to say such a thing, of course, is to oppress them. But this is very concerning to me because I want to know why it should make any difference whether the parents, whether you're male or female, have a vested interest in how their children are raised. Whether you're male or female should be irrelevant, and the man's perspective, the husband's perspective, should be weighed just as significantly as the mother's perspective. But we don't do that today, and that's evident by all the men who I've heard from over the last few weeks. It's very disturbing to me. Why should men be pushed aside as though their opinion on this doesn't matter when the facts are they're not interested in oppressing women. They just want their children to be raised at home by their mommies like they were. Why is that such an evil thing?
Just very quickly before we go back to the phones, one of the things that I've noted, the more kids you have, the quicker they grow up. And you just marvel every birthday how fast they're growing up. Is this just me? Can 20 years really blink by that fast?
Well, according to Wendy Dreskin, she addresses that at the end of this review, too, and she says she urges mothers-to-be and mothers of young children to read my book because they need to understand that the children do grow up fast. And by the time they get into later grades of elementary school, they don't want to spend all their free time with you anyway. And so grab the moments while you have them, while they think you're just, you know, the greatest thing in the world. And you still can mold them as much as possible when they're young.
And as they get older, they still think you're pretty great. They just are unwilling to admit to it.
Okay, good.
That's the way it works. Becky is calling from Canada. She listens on the Internet. Becky, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Hello?
Yes.
Hi, sorry. My question is, my husband is a pastor here in Canada, a Lutheran pastor, and he graduated almost 3 years ago. And in that time, he incurred about $45,000 Canadian debt in student loans. In that time, we had a daughter. She's almost five now. And my question is, I'm really struggling with, you know, whether, like, I love staying home with her, and I love being with her, you know, at the end of the day when she comes home from kindergarten. But at the same time, we struggle financially because of the student loan debt. And my question is, you know, is it a sin for me to go to work to help pay off those debts? Or, you know, I really struggle with, you know, what's a good best thing is to do there.
Becky, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay, let's deal again, because you are not against women working per se. Mm-hmm. It's the attitudes that drive women in the workforce and out of the home that you have a serious bone of contention with.
Right, I'm addressing really almost a separate issue. However, that said, I always encourage people who are truly struggling with the financial end of this to just put down on you know, paper exactly what they're looking at. For example, it sounds like her daughter's in kindergarten, so that frees her up a bit. I don't know how long she's in kindergarten, but it frees her up to look at what she might be able to do during those hours in which her child is not with her. So I would encourage moms to do part-time work when they find themselves in that financial bind, not just because, not just for the obvious reasons, but because part-time work, if you already have another income, can actually be more advantageous than a full-time salary, particularly if your child's young. Again, you have to offset those costs with daycare or babysitting after school or whatever. So it just doesn't always come out in the wash. Part-time work can work very well, particularly if you do it during the hours that, you know, your child's in school or in the evening or the weekends. So that's what I usually suggest as a helpful way of being able to balance the two.
You talk about the first year of motherhood and how in the past it was considered indelicate to discuss the real difficulties of that first year, and you disagree. That should, you say that should be something we do talk about. Talk about it.
I do, and that, and I say that that's the one area where I believe my generation, I say, has the upper hand, because I talk so much in this book about previous generations and how much better off they were in their attitudes. But I do think that we are at a great place because we are allowed to talk about anything and everything under the sun, which has its good points and bad points. But when it comes to motherhood, it's a very good thing. I do not believe that we are helping women and or daughters in any way, shape, or form by withholding the truth about how difficult it is, or how difficult I should say it can be, to be at home with a baby. And I get into there the whole sleep issue, the breastfeeding, and the colic. And those are the three areas that I talk about very, very, you know, very openly. So you have to be comfortable with that, because that's what I experience, that's what friends have experienced, and that doesn't mean that you will experience it as a negative, per se, but most people do. And when I say negative, that's probably not the right word. It's just so challenging that it can be overwhelming. It can be very difficult to enjoy the moments with your baby because you're contending with these physicalities of the work that is just overwhelming. For example, my one daughter had colic, not my one daughter, my only daughter, had colic. My son doesn't, or didn't. So you may or you may not have that experience, but if you do, it's going to be bad, you know, and so I lay out how and why it's bad. So I want people to know going into it what they're going to be dealing with, and I think that previous generations just didn't discuss it. I mean, that's why so many women today are like, why didn't I hear, my mother didn't tell me this. Unfortunately, I had a mother who did. She's not a sugarcoater at all, so I, again, had a leg up there. But so those are the three areas that I talk about.
We're concluding our seven-part series on working mothers with Suzanne Venker, former middle school English teacher, mother of two here in St. Louis, and author of the new book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. You can read an excerpt of this book at the website for Spence Publishing, www.spencepublishing.com. That's spencepublishing.com. Now, I'd like to go through some of the email that we have been receiving over the last couple of weeks from our listeners with questions. I want to go through it in kind of rapid-fire form here, one by one, so we can get as much of it as we can and still leave time near the end of our conversation here to talk about how marriage changes with children, too. Let's begin with Tammy, who writes this from North Carolina. Many young women do not know how to care for an infant, keep up a home, or cook home-cooked meals because they have spent all their time in school and having fun or working when they're not in school. Question: do you feel that sending our children off to public or private school is actually hurting our girls from learning how to keep a home clean, care for children, and cook? Your thoughts.
No. My first response would be no. I don't think that we're doing them a disservice by having them go to school and focus on a career. I just urge us to not leave out this other significant part, because she's absolutely right. Women don't know how to cook today, and whatever... I'm thinking of some of my neighbors on the street who are at home, actually, and still don't cook. So it's not even relevant to whether you're working or not. You know, it's ridiculous that we cannot cook anymore. I think it's terrible. But, no, I don't think we should be learning that in lieu of the education. No, just in addition to.
Another listener writes this. Suzanne, I admire the premise of your book, but parenting realities are growing ever more complex. Most families can get by with very little during the years when children are young. However, does your book address the coming economic crisis for one-income families as their children head off for college? College is expensive, Suzanne. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I do talk about that, actually. I can't remember now what chapter. Oh, well, of course, the chapter that talks about money. In there, I refer to the fact that the majority of, you know, you hear so much about needing to save for college. And what I address in my book is that while that's all fine and true, the reality of the statistics shows something very different, and that is to say that 80% of people who go to college go to public universities, not the private universities that cost $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year, whatever they are today. They cost, at the time, the figure that I had at the time in which I wrote this book, and that's probably going to be a little bit off now, but was $2,800 a year for public universities. So if 80% of the people are going to public universities and they're $2,800 a year, again, that was several years ago, so it's probably a little bit higher, that doesn't warrant the need to have two people in the workforce for 18 years to come up with the amount that it would cost to put them through college.
One more email here as time permits. Rebecca writes this. I've heard variations of the statement, quote, if I'm happy doing what I want, then the kids will be happy. I've heard this as a justification for working and especially for getting a divorce. I always think, aren't you really saying that you're expecting your children to be more of an adult than you are? Is it just me or is that the message? Is it taking advantage of a child's unconditional love for the parent? What do you think, Suzanne?
Oh, I agree. I agree completely. We are asking children to deal with things that they're not ready to deal with, and they are not going to be happier because you go to work. When I was on that CNN interview, the last thing they asked me before they went off to commercial, and I never got to answer it, was, maybe your daughter wants to see you go to work. And I barely had two words out before we went off the air. So I was astounded that somebody, you know, I couldn't figure out whether that was just a leading question or if they really believed that. And that is so sad to me because no child wants to see you go to work. They want to be with you. And unless you're abusing them or you're just a disaster at home, they don't really care whether you're happy or fulfilled. All they care about is if you're there.
Jean Marie writes, not so long ago, a woman married, raised her children, and helped her parents when the time came, even helped her mother with her grandparents, etc., and those in the family who never married or had children. These days, so many women work and can't necessarily keep up with their own homes and families, and their elders are lonely, in need, and often undercared for. How will our children come to care about and for others and their own ailing parents without the modeling of such care by us now?
Do we need to say anything more to that? That's great. That's perfect.
Are we teaching our children today, and I thought about this recently in context of preaching, but are we teaching our children today to care for us in our latter years in the way that we care for them in their early years?
No, exactly. I mean, it's moving away from nurturing and the concept of, or not the concept, the significance of nurturing and how that makes us function as a society. And Stanley Greenspan, who's the child psychiatrist who wrote the book The Irreducible Needs of Children with Barry Brazelton, addresses this with respect to this focus on work and the economics of raising children instead of understanding the significance of this nurturing role. And that's, of course, you're right, it comes right back to you when you're elderly and you need that care.
Two final questions here. How does marriage change after children?
The fourth thing that I discuss in this chapter is titled Men, Marriage, and Motherhood. And what I try to do there is not be... my intent is not to be preachy in any way, but to just discuss the reality of what happens to marriages after children come into the picture. And the truth of the matter is that the things that our parents and grandparents were taught to think about before you got married, things like your in-laws and your goals and your priorities and your religion and children, were kind of a focus of, you know, discussion. And this is no longer the case. Today's focus is on romantic love and the concept that love will see you through. And there isn't a lot of focus or discussion about the reality of how your marriage is going to be affected once that wanes, which is a scary, a little touchy thing to talk about, because the concept isn't that you stop loving, but that whatever those feelings were that you had at the beginning, it's only inevitable that the stresses of daily life, particularly children, are going to cause that to transform. It's not that it goes away, but it just changes. And we need to start dealing with what the reality of marriage is, because I think that's so, once children come in, I mean, and that's so, it's so relevant to the divorce rate, for example. And I can speak from personal example from that, because I was married before. And I absolutely believe that, hook, line, and sinker, that love would see you through, and that you could change your spouse and you could make things happen if you had love. And my point there in this chapter is that love is definitely not enough.
Suzanne, finally, with only about 30 seconds here, are you suggesting that we go back to the time of the 40s and the 50s?
No, I'm not at all. And, of course, that's what my enemies will want to say, I guess. But no, not at all. We couldn't go back even if we tried. What I'm suggesting is that we look at what was good back then, we look at what is good today, and we try to marry those two ideas. We move back a little bit toward what worked instead of just, you know, throwing out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak. Don't chuck the whole thing about the 50s, because there are a lot of great things about the way families functioned then. But just move back a little bit from where we are now, or move back a lot, actually, from where we are now, and understand that there are some good things to be retained, and try to marry that idea with these advances in technology that allow us to lead more fulfilling lives, but just don't allow it to take over to the point where we're no longer appreciating why we're here.
Becky called earlier. I'd like to have Becky call back at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, and I will send her a free copy of Suzanne Venker's book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. Suzanne, thank you for being our guest as often as you had here during this series on working mothers.
Thanks, Todd, for having me.
Suzanne Venker is a former middle school English teacher, a mother of two here in St. Louis. She's authored the book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. You can purchase it by calling Spence Publishing toll-free, 1-888-SPEN-PUB. Seven Myths of Working Mothers is currently being offered at half price, 1-888-SPEN-PUB, or find more about the book at www.spencepublishing.com. Now tune in tonight, folks, from 8 to 9 for the rebroadcast of the first hour of Issues, Etc. We discussed the American Medical Association's endorsement of the morning after pill and President Bush's refusal to ease his restrictions on embryonic stem cell research with Dr. David Stevens. John Leo was our guest briefly to talk about the loss of the art of argument and pro-choice Catholic politicians and those who vote for them. That was John Leo. And then we also, in that first hour, rebroadcast from 8 to 9 tonight here on AM 850 KFUO, talked with Diana Sudreth about being a Christian in Utah. 8 to 9 tonight on AM 850 KFUO, the rebroadcast of the first hour of Issues, Etc. Tomorrow on the program, Bill Simon, Misunderestimated is his book. It's about the Bush administration. That's tomorrow on Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.